Welcome to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the podcast where we uncover the secrets of CEOs, entrepreneurs, and visionaries who've used public speaking to skyrocket their businesses and their bottom line. Get ready for captivating stories, valuable insights, and practical wisdom from the trailblazers who've mastered the art of the stage. I'm your host, Kelly O'Hara, and I'm thrilled to bring you their experiences and expertise directly to you. Let's get started. Welcome back to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the show where public speaking isn't just a skill, it's a superpower. I'm Kelly O'Hara, and today we're not tiptoeing around tough topics. We're going straight to the front lines. Because here's the deal. When it comes to leadership, pressure, decision-making, and owning your voice in chaotic environments, there's no training ground like law enforcement. And today's guest, he didn't just survive it. He led it, reimagined it, and now he's teaching the rest of us how to lead with more integrity, clarity, and courage, whether you're running a department or running a business. I'm talking about Jeff Weninger, a retired LAPD lieutenant with over three decades of high-stakes experience under his belt. Jeff is the founder and CEO of Law Enforcement Consultants, where he advises police departments, city leaders, universities, and legal teams on how to align modern policing practices with today's social expectations. Use of force, crowd control, campus safety, he's the guy they call when things get complicated and stakes are sky high. But Jeff isn't just here to critique. He's building blueprints. He's written a powerful new book called On Thin Ice, an LAPD Veteran's Journey to Reimagining Policing. He's written a powerful book, and it pulls back the curtain on what's broken, what's worth keeping, and how we can do it better together. From working dignitary protection details with the Secret Service to running gang enforcement units in LA to now testifying as a national expert witness and helping reshape how police departments and leaders operate, Jeff brings the kind of clarity and conviction that cuts through the noise. And here's what I really love. This guy's journey includes overcoming dyslexia, a speech impediment, and some really serious odds. He didn't just learn how to lead in crisis. He learned how to speak up in a world that didn't always make it easy. And that's why his voice matters. Today, we're diving into how leadership lessons from the force translate into business, why it's time to rethink who we hire to serve and protect, and how public speaking became one of Jeff's sharpest tools for impact. Jeff Weninger, I am so delighted to welcome you to the spotlight.
Thank you for having me.
I'm just delighted. And your resume, it just is, it's star-studded, it is powerful, and you've built a reputation on one of the toughest environments imaginable, the LAPD. I grew up in Los Angeles. I know what it's about. But take us back. What originally drew you to policing, and when did it shift from being like a job to a calling?
When I was 18 years old, if you would have told me that I was going to have a 33-year career in law enforcement, I would have told you were nuts. It really didn't interest me. I was an elite hockey player. I went on, played Division I college ice hockey on scholarship, and I was a finance major. And then I had an experience when I was 20 years old that changed the entire trajectory of my life.
Oh, you got to share.
What that was is I went out on Labor Day weekend with a hockey teammate of mine. And when the bar closed, all the students were flowing out onto a sidewalk that wasn't designed to hold all the students that were flowing out of the bar. So many of us ended up out into the street. Well, my buddy thought he'd be cute as his car full of girls was trying to navigate itself through the crowd. He thought he'd prop himself up on the hood. And the girl driving didn't think that was very funny, and she slammed on the brakes, which caused my buddy to fall off the car. In doing so, he grabbed the antenna on the hood, which kind of dates me a little bit, antennas being on the hood of the car, but he snapped it off. Lo and behold, there was a police officer up the street that saw this transpire. He came down, grabbed my buddy, placed him in handcuffs, put him in the back seat of the police car. So my thought was, well, I need to find out where they're taking him, how long it's going to take them to process him, and how much money is it going to cost to get him out of jail? And when I confronted the police officer, he was very belligerent with me and made it very clear that I needed to get back up on the sidewalk or I was going to jail as well. I'd had a couple beers, but I had my wits about. I knew I'd better comply with what he requested that I do. So I got up on the sidewalk, and it wasn't long before two backup officers arrived. And the original officer pointed directly at me, and they came up and they asked me, using an expletive, for my driver's license. And when I reached to get my wallet to retrieve my driver's license, they proceeded to beat me. And it wasn't long before I found myself in the back seat of a police car with handcuffs on, heading down to the city jail. And I was ultimately booked for disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, and interfering in official business. And while I was down at the jail, I asked where my buddy was, and they said, "But we let him go." So it was the ridiculousness of this whole thing. It was my buddy who thought he was being funny, pulling this cute prank, so to speak. I inquired about him and him being arrested and placed in the handcuffs and what would be needed to get him out of jail. And he was released, and I was ultimately the one who was arrested. So that's what really got me interested in law enforcement. I began taking some criminal justice classes, which I found to be interesting. And about a year, year and a half later, the agency that arrested me put an advertisement in the newspaper for correction officers in the jail in which I sat in the entire weekend. I applied pretty much as a joke, and I got hired. The ultimate exoneration of any wrongdoing. And that is what changed the entire trajectory of my life as a young man. My father was a sociology professor, and I decided that I wanted to follow him into academia and be a professor of criminal justice. And he encouraged me at the point that I was getting ready to start my PhD program to go get a 5 years of law enforcement experience in a large law enforcement agency. He said my studies would be much more rewarding and I would become a much more credible professor. So that's what my intent was when I first went out to Los Angeles, was to do 5 years in law enforcement, take that experience into my studies, and then become a professor of criminal justice.
You're a
Didn't,
man with a plan, but
yeah,
that's not what happened.
it's not what happened. So that's what got me into law enforcement.
No, it's interesting, and I'm sure the audience, many people in the audience, have had a good experience. Nobody likes to be pulled over for a ticket. I get it. I've had a few in my lifetime. Apparently, I have a lead foot, so I've certainly had some experience with police. And actually, everybody's been good to me, but I will say that if you've ever had the bad experience with just a belligerent policeman, something happened a long time ago, and I wanted to share this with you because of the conversation we had before, is that the perception of the police, especially these days, boy, it's shifting. It's certainly shifting. And for people like me who have benefited from, if you go to Catholic school, authority is very much part of that experience. And they used to have the police come to our school, and they'd come to our events, and they would connect. So you felt like they were the community leaders, that they were looking out for us. They were heroes, right? That's how it was presented to me. And so that's how I always felt about them. Even when I was getting a ticket, I always was like I realized, you know what? Shoot, I was speeding, so I'll take it. But I had one experience where I took a class for women's defense later on in life with Krav Maga for a weekend. And they brought in an Orange County sheriff. And one conversation with him at the front of the room changed my perception of how tough this job is. And I want to ask you about this. I remember him saying, people don't understand that there's only so many cops in every county. There's only so many police to cover a vast amount of area. And when they're busy taking people in, they're gone. They're off the streets for a few hours. But when they walk up to that car to give you a ticket, and today, and especially today, when they could have two people in the car, four or five people in the car, and they got tinted windows. This is the scariest job in the world, is to walk up to a car these days. And so when they walk up with this authority that they're ready to make a move if need be, it's really them protecting themselves and posturing in a way that people know it's going to be a problem for you if you are going to fight this experience that you've obviously brought on yourself by speeding or doing whatever you're doing. What do you think of that?
Well, really, it's about maintaining a balance for a police officer. because we don't want to be hypervigilant where we see every situation as a potential opportunity for somebody to kill us, and where we're treating the people that we're interacting with through that lens. What we have to do is we have to maintain the balance where we're comfortable and know that we have the competency level in all of our skill sets, whether it's in pugilistics, grappling, firearms, marksmanship, all of that sort of thing, that if it does go sideways, that I'm aware enough that I will recognize the threat and through the training that I have, be able to respond appropriately and carry myself with that confidence and command presence, but not view the situation through a hypervigilant mentality or mindset where it impacts how we actually treat people. We still need to treat everybody with the highest level of respect. Reality is the vast majority of people that law enforcement officers have contact with on any given day are good law-abiding citizens that may have made a mistake or that are actually having the worst day of their lives. And as a police officer, you can very significantly impact that type of experience for the person. Yes, the reality is that there are people and bad actors out there that want to harm the police, and we have to be prepared and able to respond effectively to that under those rapidly unfolding tactical scenarios where you're making split-second decisions. But really, what makes you successful in those circumstances is the training that you have and the confidence that you have in your ability, not this overarching hypervigilance and treating the public as if they're all bad actors, because they're far from it, regardless of the communities that you're policing. That's been my experience.
You have really been in some of the toughest areas. Some areas in Los Angeles are not places that are necessarily law enforcement friendly, perception-wise. So your perspective is powerful, certainly needed. Do you enjoy that part of the job? Do you feel like that is really rewarding, trying to educate the police on that side? On how to approach community and how to bridge the gap that's on right now with LAPD. Wow, is that challenging, I'm sure, with ICE there. All the things that are happening in the world is pretty complicated. It's a little bit on the edge these days. What advice would you give to the public on how to maneuver through that situation or what kind of perspective they might consider?
The reality is, the vast majority of police officers are absolutely wonderful people. Their motivations for being in law enforcement are pure and come from the heart, and they truly are committed to serving their communities that they're assigned to. But the reality is that there's always bad apples in every career. And unfortunately, it's the stories that we hear about them that hijack the narrative that many people in the community hear and inform their opinions by. The reality is only about 20% of people will have a direct contact with law enforcement during their adult life. So about 80% of people are forming their opinions about the police by what they hear from other people or what they see on television. And we all know that is the furthest thing from reality. And in my career, being a white male with blue eyes, I can't tell you how many times I had people come up to me and go, "Oh, there's the white KKK hood wearing, blue-eyed, racist cop," using that type of language to explain how they perceived me and saw me. But it was important that I step back from that and realize that I can't take that personally. I took that as an opportunity to change people's minds and give them an experience that would make them question this opinion and perception that they had of me. And I found that really during my career, the people that you can impact the most in changing their opinions are the young minds. So when I had an opportunity, I would go into the projects in South Los Angeles and I would throw the football with the kids there. I'd buy them an ice cream cone. And that did two things. One of two things, firstly, was it showed them that I did not see them as the enemy. And then it gave them an opportunity to an experience and experience engaging with me, a police officer that looked different than them, to see and show them that I'm not the enemy either. So when they're
Hey, that's so powerful. That is so powerful. And don't, it's amazing. We forget how powerful we are as individuals, that we can shift perspective. It only takes meeting one person who you perceive is on the other side. It could be a policeman. It could be someone from Iran. It could be someone from Russia. I've been blessed to be raised in a family that just didn't see prejudice. They didn't see skin color. We were involved in sports, and sports invites all people, and it wasn't sexist. So I'm kind of lucky. I'm kind of open book. And you know, cultures, they're considered cultures, and they get a reputation for the way they deal with things. It just is. But it takes one person to shift your opinion to the better. If you can say, oh, no, they're really good. They're no, I know someone from that area, that culture, that industry, and they're wonderful. They yeah. were terrific. We had a great conversation. And that can take a lot of heat out of the fear that people have from there being a difference between us.
I think it's really important that your listeners understand something about my personal background. I was adopted. My mother was a teenage pregnant girl, and she put me up for adoption. And I was adopted by my parents. My father, he is a sociology professor at Kent State in Ohio. And my mother, she was a chemist for DuPont. And they originally wanted to have four children, each 1 year apart. And about 12 years in of marriage, they weren't having any luck. So they started looking at the adoption options that they had. And right about the time that they were approved for adoption, lo and behold, my mother becomes pregnant with my sister. So they chose to have my sister, but move forward with adoption because they still had this dream of having four children close in age. So they adopted me. And then they adopted my brother. He's Japanese. And then they fostered a sister. My foster sister is Black. And I grew up in the 60s and 70s in Kent, Ohio, with this multiracial family. And in a university town, which at the time was rather progressive for the time, but still was not immune to the microaggression of racism that we experienced. But it was that experience of growing up in the Midwest with a multiracial family that I took into my law enforcement career. So I viewed things very differently than my peers in law enforcement.
Wow, that's powerful. What a leg up in life to have that experience of having a family from all different cultures. And it's all wonderfully different, and yet all the same. We're all together. I love that. So that's part of your personal value system. And from even our conversation prior to this, your parents, who you are super close with, have really made a difference for you in the way you look at the world, haven't they?
Well, they had, my mother was highly educated, where women at that time didn't have the levels of education that she did. And she was a very civic-minded individual. She was a president of Legal Women Voters. She was a city councilwoman in my hometown. And she was very involved with the church in the local community. And my father and my mother, they were co-founders of the Kent Environmental Council, which still is active today in the city of Kent, my hometown. So they saw things that were larger than them in life. And I was raised to value the importance of engaging with the community in a way that you can improve life for everybody. It's larger than you. And you need to find whatever that is that you're passionate about, that you can give back to society and help others be their best, the best version of themselves. And that's really what I gleaned from being raised by my parents. My father was a very astute individual. He didn't speak often, but when he did, it was certainly worth listening to. He never told me how to think. He told me what I should be considering. It seems to me, Jeffrey, you should be considering this. And he would allow me to come to my own conclusions. But what he would ask is that I would articulate the rationale for the conclusion that I had. Basically, what he was doing without me even realizing it was developing my critical thinking skills.
Absolutely. He's teaching you how to think. That is beautiful. And discern and make your own decisions.
And let's be honest, in society today, critical thinking at times is one thing that's significantly lacking in how people look at issues and evaluate them and form their opinions. And on law enforcement, the reason that's so important is because your attitudes and beliefs and your opinions are going to impact what your behaviors and actions are going to be.
Sure, they inform your decisions, they inform your outlook. So you really had a leg up to get to start with a family that looked at the world the way that they did and how involved they were. And so that's a gift that you bring to the table that not everybody has that benefit. So let's talk about the next step. You created law enforcement consultants. What was the gap you were seeing in the system that said, yeah, I got to launch this myself, which I'm finding out is very much a trend of yours. I'll just launch it myself. Tell me about that move.
Really, it's just an extension of my experiences on the job. In LAPD, I always was trying to challenge myself. And as an officer, I worked the Elite Metropolitan Division. And for your listeners, that's kind of like the special forces of the police department. That's a SWAT and a canine and the mounted unit. And one of the functions that we had was dealing with crowd control in these large, violent demonstrations that we unfortunately too often had to confront and deal with in the city of Los Angeles. And I worked alongside the Secret Service doing dignitary protection. Anytime the president, vice president, first lady, or any head of state came to the city of Los Angeles, we were part of the security detail working with the Secret Service of the State Department protecting those individuals. So I had a got a quite a bit of elite experience. But from that, and during that time when I was working Metropolitan Division, the LAPD was being investigated by the Department of Justice. And there was a huge scandal that was unraveling in Rampart Division of the LAPD. And it dealt with the crash unit, which was the gang unit. And essentially, what was happening, we had officers that were committing bank robberies off duty, planting evidence on people, getting involved in shootings on duty and planting guns to justify them, stealing pounds of cocaine out of evidence lockup and selling it on the streets for their personal financial gain. We're talking about some of the most egregious types of police misconduct and corruption that you could even imagine. And this was all coming to light at the time that I was just about to make sergeant. And
Oh.
when you make sergeant, you get to put in a wish list of three divisions. And at the time, there were 18 patrol divisions with the LAPD at the time. And you put in your three, Rampart would have been at the bottom of the list. I was selected to go to Rampart because they were putting in a new management team to clean it all up. And then while working there, I became and was selected to be the officer in charge of the newly formed gang enforcement detail that replaced the crash unit. All crash units in the LAPD were disbanded because of that corruption scandal. And I now was leading the gang unit in Rampart after this huge scandal, where we needed to focus on bridging the gap between this trust that had been lost between the communities that were being served and the police department. And we were under a consent decree for 10 years. So I learned a lot with that. And I impressed the chief, William Bratton, enough that when I was done with my 3 years, you had a maximum tenure that you could work in that unit before you had to move on. That was one of the measures that was put into place to help prevent corruption, was you could only serve 3 years in that particular assignment. I moved on and I would brief the chief and I wrote the chief's rationale for all officer-involved shootings and lethal force cases for the LAPD that was submitted to the Honorable Board of Police Commissioners for the final ultimate adjudication of those cases in regards to the actual force that was used, the decision to draw and exhibit the firearm, and the tactics that were used by the officers leading up to the incident. So I had these types of experiences. So I saw the good, the bad, and the ugly. During my time in that role, working for Chief Bratton, and then the following role that I had, where I was the officer in charge of the detective entity that investigated all officer-involved shootings and lethal force cases, we're talking over 700 cases I had my hands on. So I saw the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I retired and I thought, what a waste for me to take the experience that I have after 33 years of service out in the city of Los Angeles to just have it end there. It's really about the best practices, management best practices for law enforcement. Unfortunately, law enforcement tends to have this insular nature where we don't learn from the mistakes of other law enforcement agencies. We're seeing today mistakes by large law enforcement agencies that are the exact same mistakes we were making over 2 decades ago. and we're required to be on a consent decree to fix and overcome. And what my company does is it helps provide this management best practices, and it not only helps bridge this gap of the trust that the community needs to have in the law enforcement, but it reduces liability, enhances efficiency, it maximizes the potential for optimal outcomes in these rapidly unfolding tactical scenarios that oftentimes result in the community being in conflict with the police department and critical of the police department's actions. Because the reality is this, that law enforcement is only effective to the extent that the public accepts and supports the actions that they're taking. And we need to understand that. And there's a blueprint for this. And that's what I try to push on these organizations. There's management best practices that can help organizations have better outcomes, most significantly in these incidents that are critical to the trust that the police department must have with the community.
Well, let's talk about this, because obviously with the pedigree that you have, you're fantastic to ask some really tough questions right now. And they must have had a lot of trust in you to have hired you to deal with the Rampart Division and all the corruption that was going on. Can we hire you to step into the political process and manage some of the insanity that's going on there? I think you would be the perfect person to step in for that. I think you should just consider it. I know you're busy now, but I think you should consider it. We could use some work. But let's make it real time. There's no time like the present. And love the focus of accountability on things too. You can't change things till you acknowledge that they exist. The corruption has to come up for you to heal it, right? And that's across the board, whether you're talking police, whether you're talking politics. You really have to have it rise to the top and deal with it. Right now, I know I happen to be California born and bred, and I'm certainly watching it in my state. I would think it would be wonderful for our listeners to hear how you view what it's like to be a policeman in that kind of situation, since you've been through gang units and you've been through riots, and now ICE is on the forefront, especially in my state at the moment. Give us some good advice about that. Give us some perspective that will allow people to look at all sides of things, and then they can make better decisions on what kind of position they want to take.
You know, when I watched the recent events in Los Angeles on television, I saw something that really was just unfortunately very familiar to me. This isn't new. I was confronting this back as early as 1992, which was my first experience with civil unrest. And it happened to be the Rodney King riots. And I had a very integral part within the organization, the LAPD, dealing with these demonstrations. And the reality is, I like to deal, like you mentioned, and I'd like to talk about the importance of that, is being accurate in what we're talking about, being honest about what we're talking about. The reality is that these events, these past few weeks in Los Angeles, are rather isolated. The narrative that was coming from the federal government that Los Angeles is on the verge of burning down and all, that just wasn't accurate. That's not true. It was isolated to a very small portion of the city, and 99.9% of Angelenos weren't impacted whatsoever by these events. Nor is it really being carried out by people that are Angelenos. Unfortunately, we have people that are professional demonstrators, and their entire purpose is to go and travel to these types of demonstrations to create chaos and to create problems for the police, to hijack the narrative. And the reality is that law enforcement has a structure. It's incident command system. The LAPD is one of the most highly trained organizations when it deals with crowd management and control. And to the extent you get to the point where the LAPD in and of itself may have its resources stretched, the incident command system, the structure in which you're working under, has an accommodation for that. It's called mutual aid, where you can call in the resources of the sheriff's department and other surrounding law enforcement agencies to assist you. Because the reality with these federal the federalization of the National Guard and the deployment of the Marines in the city of Los Angeles had zero impact of what was going on in the streets. Their authority was so limited to just federal buildings and the protection of federal officers, had nothing to do with what was going on the streets. So the narrative that was being shared from the federal government that if it weren't for these federal entities being sent into Los Angeles, that the city would burn, that's not accurate at all, because they had no bearing whatsoever in regards to the boots on the ground dealing with these people that were throwing these bricks and these Molotov cocktails and things like that at the police officers. It was the state of California's law enforcement officers that were working there with the LAPD and a mutual aid that were impacted by this and had to resolve this situation. Essentially, federal agencies that were there had no impact whatsoever.
Wow, that is interesting to me, and I really appreciate your perspective from an expert point of view. So do you feel it could have all been handled, that we did not need to have ICE here at all, that we did not need to have, not
National Guard, National
yeah,
Guard, Marine
that we didn't need the National Guard here, that we were fine without them, and that the LAPD can really manage all that really well successfully?
To the extent, we'll just be honest about what their role was. Their role and their authority was limited to protection of federal buildings and the protection of federal agents. That's it. That's all that they were capable of being deployed to. They couldn't help on the street. They couldn't help making arrests of people throwing rocks and bottles and things like that. That was law enforcement's responsibility. And that's something that the LAPD and the LA County Sheriff's Department and the surrounding agencies that assisted in the mutual aid were having to deal with, and who are responsible for dealing with and are highly trained to deal with. The CHP has a special unit that deals with crowd control. They're very well trained and very efficient in what they do. And unfortunately, a lot of this stuff, it was just politicized.
I was going to say, this is really getting down to, this was all, it's confirmed, it's all very political. This whole thing was really a lot more political. But let me ask you, these people that you talk about that are come into cities to cause problems, what can be done about them? What can you legally do with people that come in to wreak havoc in your city and cause all these problems? There's got to be some remedy for that.
I think that's what I would like to see the federal government looking at. If you got people that are crossing state lines with the intention of committing these types of felonies, and you can connect those dots, you need to put together a prosecutional effort to identify, seek these people out, and hold them accountable. I would say that in being on, I got to be critical of California, of Los Angeles, of the LAPD, to the extent that you can't, I don't think there's an American alive that does not support the deportation of people that are here illegally that are committing violent crimes. I don't think there's anybody, I don't care what your political ideology is, that's not going to be refuted by anybody. Yes, absolutely, that's what we should be doing. And unfortunately, as a result of California being a sanctuary state, and the city of Los Angeles being a sanctuary city, there's actual laws in place that prohibit the law enforcement agencies from doing certain things, which is aiding and assisting in deportation efforts, or even identifying and sharing information with the federal government for the purposes of deportation, or housing people and holding them in custody for the deports. And now, we, regardless of what your political ideology may be, I think there's fair evaluation of people that say, I don't like that. I think that's wrong. I think those laws are an overreach. I think that that's a legitimate statement. And when my criticism is that we need to find a way where law enforcement in California is assisting the federal government in their efforts to do what I think every American would want them to do, which is deport these bad actors that are causing American citizens to be victims of violent crime. Unfortunately, our custody facilities aren't holding these people. and turning them over to the federal government.
Criminal.
And that's
It's criminal. I'm
and
sorry. It
if
just.
we're and so there needs it's like I said earlier, it's about a balance, isn't it? So we can't just say, no, these are our political ideology positions and we're going to force this down your throat. We're not going to assist with that. We need to meet halfway somewhere. We have to say, okay, we're willing to do this. And then you're not going to, there's nobody that's going to be critical of the LAPD or any law enforcement agency in the state of California if they're assisting or making it easier for ICE to deport these violent criminals. And if that, and if they were to do that, then perhaps we wouldn't have these circumstances where, like 70% of these people that are being detained and deported aren't violent criminals. You probably wouldn't have that because they wouldn't be required to throw out this huge net. They would be able to more surgically be able to better use their resources to go after these people that everybody agrees need to be deported.
This is all a political move because you're absolutely right. Nobody wants violent people to be allowed to stay here, but you only have so many places you can house these people in the interim before you get them out. You don't want to load up your prison so everything is overcrowded and insane. You've got to have people aren't thinking. I feel like it's not the process isn't being as well thought through as it should. Again, sanctuary city doesn't mean everybody gets to stay. No one wants the gardener picked up or the people on the farms picked up. We don't want that. People have been here a long time. We don't want that. But we sure don't need people that are causing problems or bringing their political beliefs into our country, throwing their flag around. And look, if you espouse what's going on over there, you go over there and fix it.
Yeah.
But don't be causing problems here. Don't be causing violent crime here. You need to go now, and however that happens is fine with me. I've had enough. This sanctuary city idea is good in concept, but it's a little scary that it's all getting out of hand and no one seems to be in agreement about it. However, I love it that you come with such an open perspective. And from the police perspective, I had not actually been told specifically that they are separate, that they get that the police and ICE have completely separate roles that they cannot cross over at all.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, yeah, it's law in this in the state of California where local law enforcement, local and state law enforcement, they're not allowed to assist.
As you
And
can see, as we talk, I'm biting my tongue. So
it's
if the
but and
state
it's
of California is having some problems, I have a problem with for
and it's
sure.
and I think it's important that your listeners understand how this we evolved to this point. As far back as 1979, under Chief Daryl Gates of the LAPD,
I
he
remember.
implemented a order, Special Order 40, actually, where the LAPD was not allowed to inquire into anybody's immigration status. And we couldn't take any enforcement action to have people detained for the purposes of deportation. And so the average person, the layman's going to look at that and go, that's kind of odd. But you have to remember what were the larger global perspective that we have to look at this through, the lens that we have to look at through in this issue, because we have to be able to engage on a daily basis with the communities that we're sworn to protect. And in Los Angeles, the reality is there's a lot of undocumented immigrants that are victims of crimes that we need to feel comfortable coming forward and reporting. We need them to feel comfortable. We always say, especially now in this heightened threat of terrorism, that if you see something, say something. So we need to create an environment that the communities that we're policing feel comfortable and aren't afraid that having contact with the police is going to result in them being deported, because we need to work with that those community members. We need to know what they're seeing. We need them to report and feel comfortable confronting us and telling us these things that can prevent a huge tragic incident from occurring. So that's why, back even as far back as 1979, that special order was put into effect, and it's still in effect today. So that's the mindset that we have. And to be honest with you, I do support that. It's
I
really
do.
important that if you're here undocumented, that you still need to feel comfortable interacting with the police. and that we are there to serve you and to protect you as well. And it's really you, the violent actors that are here illegally or legally, that need to worry about us as law enforcement officers, because it's our primary focus to deal with you, because it's you who's creating 90% of the crime. So that,
and these other immigrants are going to be witnesses in those cases. If you lose those people, they're the people that will turn in the violent criminals, that we hope they will do it, but not if they're not protected, not if they don't feel safe to do it. So I 1000% agree and appreciate that perspective. The work that you do, it focuses also on aligning like police practices with societal expectations. That's a really bold and necessary mission. And one of your key messages is who we hire as police officers matter. I would love for you to talk about that, because what needs to change in the recruitment pipeline and what traits should we be prioritizing, especially today with everything that's happening?
Well, it's not only who we hire, but probably even more importantly, it's how we hire. And let me explain what I mean by that. Here in the United States, our hiring process is pretty much like a deselection process. So if you don't have a criminal record, your finances are in order, and you've basically lived an upstanding life, good chance you can be hired as a police officer. And that's really not the best practice when you look outside of the United States on how things are done in other countries. Many of the other countries, they hire after an extensive process. And let me explain this to you. The United States, the average academy length is 800 hours. Let's put that in the context. To apply for your cosmetology license, you need 1,500 hours of training, nearly twice that of a police officer. So that's what occurs here in the United States. Now, let's look abroad. Look at some of the Nordic countries. Their training before you hit the streets as a police officer is 2 and 3 years. It's equivalent to an undergraduate degree, where you're not only getting the academic background, so you have a stronger understanding of the issues that drive the sociological things you're going to be confronting, but it gives you all the tactical prowess and training and grappling and firearms and tactics and all those sorts of things. But what's happening during that entire time is you're being evaluated. You're being watched. How receptive are you to the training? You know, do you have, and these are things I don't think anybody would argue, but are you empathetic? Are you a critical thinker? Yeah. You have moral reasoning? Are you self-aware? All of those sorts of things are being evaluated and assessed while people are watching over these 2 and 3 years of your training. Do you possess? And then, and only then after you're done, do they make the selection on who gets hired? So you see, that's about
that. How do you change it? That's such good thinking. It's so logical and rational, and it would serve the public. How do you get that instituted in a country that is a fast food processor?
Well, unfortunately, it's always about the dollar, isn't it? There's a cost attributed to that. So you're talking about that. We're talking about an entity, an institution of law enforcement that cannot turn on a dime. It's like trying to turn a huge cargo ship at sea. It takes forever for change to occur. But the reality, and what's so important, is that I present some of these things because my book, I talk about my personal background and my professional experiences and my practical insights into actionable solutions that I think need to be implemented to help law enforcement be successful moving forward in the 21st century. And they're not just theoretical in nature. I've traveled abroad to look at what other countries are doing and to share their success stories, because there's something that can be learned from that. And yes, granted, here in the United States, we have a unique population. We're so heavily armed here with the Second Amendment, which is very different than some of the other countries, which changes the mindset that police officers have to confront their jobs on a daily basis. Yes, that's true. But that doesn't mean that we throw the baby out with the water. Don't take the things that can be learned from how other countries do things in regards to how they hire police officers and select those who are most likely to be successful in law enforcement. And it's quite interesting. People now, there's huge debate on education, having an education requirement for law enforcement, and training. And I think, unfortunately, people conflate the two. They're different. So, education to me is, are you compatible for law enforcement? Do you have the mindset and the deep thought and critical thinking necessary to understand the role that you actually serve in being a law enforcement officer in this modern era of policing? And then you have the other side, which is competency. Do you possess the skill sets, the marksmanship, the pugilistics, the grappling skills to carry yourself with the confidence to be able to act appropriately and ultimately have an ultimate optimal outcome when confronted with what I always say, police officers are not paid for what they do on a daily basis. They're paid for what, God forbid, they might have to do. And that's when you earn your paycheck. And it's the combination of those two things, the balance of those two things, that will make you be the best police officer you possibly can be. You can train all day long, but if you're not receptive to that training and open-minded to it, it's not going to serve a purpose. And I also have this other saying that culture eats training for breakfast. What I mean by that is, I don't care what I train the officers to do. When it comes right down to their actions are more closely going to reflect the culture of the organization than the training of the organization. And if those two are not aligned, you're going to have problems. And that's what my law enforcement consultants is all about. It's about trying to align the police culture with the policies and procedures that have proven and demonstrated empirically through research and studies the best practices that should be implemented for law enforcement to be successful moving forward.
I'm guessing you're really busy. Is there a goal of wanting to completely go across the country and get to every police department to see if you can impact and evolve the current system that's here? Or are you just waiting for the call to come in?
I got to be honest with you. We talk about culture, and it's not just culture of any one given law enforcement agency. There is an insular culture of law enforcement across the country. And I spoke a bit about it earlier, where we oftentimes, as organizations, don't learn from the mistakes of other law enforcement agencies. We don't look or even think outside of our small little world of our own organization. And the reality is that my thoughts and my vision, there's quite a bit of resistance to it. Why? Because it requires some change.
That's it. You're moving people's cheese, and people don't like to have their cheese moved unless they're the ones moving it. But it needs to be done. And what you just described is not just the police, it's the political system, it's the way the world is working right now. This is across the board. It isn't just the United States that's going through this, it's globally happening where all this corruption's coming up. And people are actually now, because it's surging, they can't be apathetic much longer. You're going to have to show up. You're going to have to participate. You're going to have to make new decisions, which means you're going to have to really look at this, be accountable for what we've got, and start coming up with solutions and considering alternatives to the status quo. It's not just the police department, it's globally how countries are run, how people are doing business together. And one of the things I love, you're talking about leadership tactics in law enforcement, but it has direct impact and application in business. Share with us one of the leadership lessons from the field that every CEO should be using just in their own, I'll just say with a company, with their own company. We'll go ahead and leave the politics in the powerful positions that are making poor decisions. Just go with business. Give us one of those leadership lessons you would love to share.
think the key as any leader who's successful is that you have to recognize that there's different types of leadership, and not any one type of leadership is successful in all situations. So you have the, like an autocratic leader. There's times when you have to unilaterally impose a policy or procedure. You make that decision, dead blank, the buck stops with you as the leader. Absolutely. But then you have at times that you have to be more democratic in your leadership style, where you need to be taking in what I call exposing yourself to these relationships or creative encounters, is that what I like to call them, where you are engaging people that have opinions that conflict with yours. Because it's only then that you're going to be able to flush everything out. The days of law enforcement or even business of imposing your authority on the people you serve or you provide a product to or what have you, those days are gone. People have expectations and they need to feel as if they're being valued, heard, and respected. And you truly can't be impactful as a leader until you gain trust in people. And how do you gain trust? You gain trust by first allowing people to know you, and then they'll like you, and only then will they trust you. So it's that formula that you have to use, whether you're being autocratic, democratic, or you're transformative, where you're allowing people to be innovative and creative and they drive the direction of the organization. And you do that. Why? Because it's new ideas. It's developing a succession plan. These are going to be the future people in leadership positions of the organization, whether it's a business or a law enforcement agency. And it's really, that's the key. That's the key in leadership and understanding that one style is not going to make you successful. I'll tell you this, look at it this way. Kansas City Chiefs, if they had a team of nobody but Patrick Mahomes's, they wouldn't win a ball game, would they? But Patrick Mahomes is probably one of the best quarterbacks of all time. It's about being diversified in your skill sets and being able to be the leader that the moment calls for, and being flexible in that. That was a lesson I had to learn. And I learned that gradually throughout my career.
What? Patrick's a superstar. He is my favorite. I just love him. But guess what? Patrick needs a team. Can't do it all by yourself. No matter how great you are, you're going to have to hold hands with other people to get it done. So yeah, that's a great comparison. So I'd love to get over and talk about this incredible book that you've written that's about to hit the stands, On Thin Ice, an LAPD veteran's journey to reimagining policing. Tell me, what made you decide this is a story that's got to be told? It's clear it does, but what is it that made you finally sit down in the busy schedule that you have and say, I got to write this book?
One of the things, I'd talk to people and people would inquire about my experiences and I would share the stories, many of the stories that I've shared with you here today. And they would say, you got to write a book. And I'll be honest, I don't know the first thing about writing a book. I've done a lot of writing. Like I said, I used to write the rationale for Chief Bratton and following Chief Bratton. It was Chief Charlie Beck, their rationale for the adjudication of all officer involved shooting and lethal force cases. And some of those, 36, 40 pages long, you had to know how to write. But doing that, knowing how to write a book where it's going to captivate and capture the interest of the audience who's reading it. Because really, my goal was to, one, enlighten the reader, secondarily, empower them, and then ultimately, when they put the book down and they're done, have them feel hopeful. That was my ultimate goal. So it was really people encouraging me to do it, and then having the courage to plug your nose and jump. It's been a long and tedious process for me. I've learned a lot of lessons, and I was open to the experts to help assist me and direct me and how I needed to best get my message across. Because the one thing that I learned was that I'm a character in my book. I have to develop myself as a character. And that required me to share some things about my life that I wouldn't necessarily be comfortable sharing under normal circumstances. But I felt that it's worthwhile to essentially, like I said, build that trust where people are going to read the book and say, there's something to this. They have to trust me. Trust that I have a voice in this and that I am a subject matter expert in this area and that I'm not naive enough to think that I have the solutions. That's not what this book is about. The book is about creating the dialogue to have the difficult conversations and to be honest about the deficiencies in law enforcement so we can address them and work cooperatively moving forward, not just as law enforcement as a profession, but essentially as a society where we take in the opinions and the attitudes and beliefs of those people that we serve and incorporate that into our decision-making process and how we move forward. And then and only then are we going to be successful. Because really, during my 3 decades, over 3 decades law enforcement experience, the one thing that I found was that what we do is we identify these problems and we just rename the solution. And there are solutions that haven't worked. And that's a definition of insanity, just doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome. We really need to reimagine policing and change how we view things. And it deals with the civilianization of law enforcement to the extent that we put people in influential positions where their voices matter and they're not just being heard. They actually are impacting what ultimately will occur. Law enforcement needs to listen carefully, question thoughtfully, and speak deliberately. And that's what we're doing. Everything we do moving forward
Pretty
needs to
cool.
be intentional, deliberate, and purposeful. And just doing things the way we have, just because that's the way we've always done it, is not going to work moving forward. It just isn't. So, On Thin Ice, the title has a little bit to do with my hockey background because the lessons I learned in leadership and ice hockey, I carried into my law enforcement career. And I talk about that in the book. But more importantly, I feel that law enforcement is on thin ice. And that to me is an opportunity for law enforcement to recognize that and to take the steps forward to impact how we're going to improve moving forward rather than having that imposed on us as a profession.
It's interesting to me, and I appreciate your perspective because it's wonderful to say the major goal here is to create conversation. If people can talk together, they can look at what's going on and come up with solutions if someone's listening. Nobody has all the answers, and doing it the way we've been doing it, and this is across the board right now. We look at the way things are done and you go, this doesn't work. But if you don't put smart people in the room and have the conversation and have everyone listen and then put their feedback in, their expertise, their perspective, their experience, then you can try some new solutions and you can do it together as a group instead of it being an opposing position. It can be, what we're doing is not working. We need to try something else. Let's vet this potential solution together. I love that as a main goal that turns into a conversation. What a valuable and meaningful goal. I love that you've done this.
And I speak from this, like on the civilianization part, it's from experience, it's what I observed in many of my critical positions. When I was working for Chief Bratton, I had a seat at the table. He was light years ahead of his peers as a law enforcement executive and chief of police. He put civilians in very highly critical positions, and they sat at the table and influenced his decisions. He had Jerry Chaliff, who oversaw the Consent Decree Bureau. He brought in Mary Grady, who had decades of experience in the media in Los Angeles, and put her in charge of media relations. Because listen, there's nothing more important than the narrative that is getting out there from the police department. And who better than somebody that has decades of experience and understands the impact certain information that's being released is going to have on the community, and what impact the withholding of information from the community is going to have. And it's such an insightful thing to recognize that perhaps those of us in law enforcement that all joined the police department and started and went through the academy may not have the most insight into these critical decisions. And that why not bring in these people that are civilians and have the expertise in these various specialized areas to help direct us? We had Luann Pennell. She was a psychologist with the Behavioral Science Services of the City of Los Angeles. And then Bratton made her in charge of the training, police training in the academy, as well as in-service training. Why not?
As you speak of, it just makes such good sense. Just does. And if that's fallen away, then we need to readdress that. And it's important for every institution to bring great qualified people to the table to look at all the options. So why does this just fall away because of politics, or we're going to do the same old?
Well, much of it has to do with this is the way we've always done it. You also have the influence of the police unions. You know, with numbers comes power for the union. So the more sworn personnel you have in an organization, the more influential and powerful they're going to be as a political entity in influencing things, not only locally, in the state perhaps, and what legislation may or may not pass. But unfortunately, their efforts oftentimes aren't in the best interest of the masses of the organization. It's sometimes self-serving for that purpose of power. But it's unfortunate. Law enforcement sometimes has this mentality of them versus us, and that gets extended to all civilian personnel, that how are these people going to do it better than us? We know we've done it. We've lived it. Although there's something to be said for that, we can't discard the expertise that they bring to the table. And it doesn't mean that we unilaterally just implement everything they tell us to do, but it certainly ought to be something we consider. They're a seat and a voice at the table that is providing us with a diversity of thought in regards to our considerations on how best to address these critical incidents that are going to impact our effectiveness in serving the communities. And it's worked. I would say Chief Bratton, in his short period of time with the department, which was about 6 years, the improvements that he made with the relationships with the most vulnerable and marginalized communities in Los Angeles has been unmatched. And he was able to do that because when he would speak about a very critical incident that may not be favorable, he was flanked by civilians that are nodding their head, reassuring the public as the chief speaks that what he is speaking is the truth, because it is the truth. It's the utilization of that type of structure and surrounding yourself by experts who may not be sworn personnel that give you that heightened level of credibility and authority with the citizens that you serve. And we need to stop viewing ourselves as it being inappropriate to impose our authority on the public, but actually incorporate them into the entire process, into the decision-making process and what we're going to ultimately do that's going to so significantly impact the community.
Would go miles finding the right people to deliver the message out to the people and giving them a seat at the table, because they're out there too. They're hearing everything that's going on. They're hearing their constituency. It would be great to bring things together and that it didn't become so isolated. But every company has these problems as well. Every industry. I've certainly been in an industry that did not welcome outside feedback. And I would say, you got to be kidding me. Are you kidding? This is the population you're trying to sell to. You need to expand your reach. So I think that carrying the torch is up to you, Jeff. I think it's clearly up to you. You need to keep moving forward. I think your book is going to be very impactful. I think it should be required reading to all police departments and hopefully in the school systems as well, so they get a chance to benefit from this kind of knowledge and to turn them on to being a difference moving forward. One of the things you told me that I thought was fabulous that we should share is that you hit some bumps in the road when trying to get your book published, and that there were certain areas that you were comfortable in and certain areas that you needed some help and you wanted to get published, and you could not get that going the way you wanted to. So what does Jeff Weninger do? Starts his own publishing company. Brilliant. Populous Publishing. You got to tell us about that.
Yeah, I found that my book, when I had editors read it, they shared it with various publishers. And I had a number of publishers come to me saying, we would like to publish your book. But I had certain conditions that I got final say on the title, final say on the cover, and I got final edits of the content of the book. And so I had a publishing company, and then I had another one come to me that gave me an offer I couldn't refuse. So I changed publishing companies. And after I had a second editor look at the book and got feedback from the beta readers, people from suburban housewives to law enforcement, people that are active in law enforcement to retired law enforcement, to people that are involved in legislation, I got feedback from people in all those areas. And then my edits. And I submitted the book with the final edits, and they wanted to change things. And the edits that they wanted to make were changing the message that I was trying to share with the reader. And so I said, well, this violates our clause of me having the final edit. So now I've essentially had a book that was complete, but I didn't have a publishing company. So I thought, it's just my personality. I'm going to create my own publishing company. And so it goes beyond like self-publishing. I'm actually started, it's called Populous Publishing. And it's there for people that have the similar goal that I have. They have a story to tell that they should have the full authority to determine what their voice is going to be. And it helps them throughout the entire process, where I provide copywriters, ghostwriters, editors, formatters, all the way through to the marketing of the book. And it's people like me who have the story but may not have the courage to just plug their nose and jump. So this will make it much easier for people that have an impactful story to tell that will be beneficial to those who read it in improving their lives and or industries or what have you, whatever the particular topic may be. But it's to give them an avenue to make their dream come true of publishing a book on their own terms.
You are unstoppable. That's it. Once again, you've walked into a new industry, and if they're not going to do it right, you'll do it yourself. You'll just create something new. And I love that you have true entrepreneurial spirit. Yet you've worked in these industries where they're very, I don't know if corporate's the right word, but certainly controlled environments that you've walked into and been able to make a difference. So you're a Renaissance man in a lot of ways. I love that. Let's talk about speaking, because the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight really is about taking your voice, your thoughts, your perspective, and getting it out there and using it in ways that, in good ways, that will make a difference for yourself, for your mission, to build your tribe, to certainly create more revenue, absolutely, but to make a difference in the world. Tell me, you've gone from elite tactical operations to commanding audiences on major platforms like NPR and Sirius. When did you realize that public speaking was going to be a major part of this and a critical tool for you?
Well, really, it's about exposure. That's a critical element of having an impact. You have to have the exposure. And to be honest, I'm a fairly private guy. I would prefer to be private, more private than I am now. But what I'm trying to accomplish doesn't allow for that. And it's just very important that I get the message out through a personal means, which is me speaking and hitting people head on in speaking engagements. And I don't have a problem speaking. I've never been afraid to speak in front of people. I'd like to be authentic. I'm not one that gets myself all anxious about trying to memorize something or no, the reality is this, my experiences are my experiences. And the fact that they're my experiences, I can talk about them in a very organic and authentic way. And I think to an extent, that's the appeal that I bring, that I can talk to people about these things, these very important issues that are confronting law enforcement in a way that resonates with them, where it's not polished, it's not professionally articulated, it's just me being honest and telling the truth about my experiences and what I see as a path forward for improvement. And that's really what it's about for me. Well, my marketing team, I'm going to have a whole university tour where who better than to speak to criminal justice students? And like you said, mandatory reading. It'd be wonderful if this book were mandatory reading for the undergraduate criminal justice student, because it addresses and brings up many critical issues that you need to be discussing prior to getting into law enforcement, and have an understanding of the impact the career could have on you. Because the whole thing we haven't talked about is the toll it takes on police officers, the suicide rates of police officers, the PTSD, the high divorce rate, and all that sort of stuff. There is a personal consequence that you pay for this line of work, and something that you need to be fully aware of and understand that it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to say you need help. It's okay to say that I want to talk to somebody about something I saw and the experience that I had, because it's not always the highly critical circumstances where it's life or death, where you've been shot at or those sorts of things. I talk about those incidents in my book, but the stuff that I struggle with is the stuff that is just sad. It's the sadness. No human being should be exposed to the amount of sadness that the modern day police officer is exposed to. And we need to help take care of them. Because unfortunately, there's a stigma associated with admitting that you're vulnerable. There's the opportunity, because police officers all have guns, and in moments of their lowest times, that they may do something very tragic that is permanent, when with proper resources provided to them, that they can work through it. But that's probably my next book, to be honest with you.
You know what? They're looking at a lot of ugly all day long. I have often considered some of the careers that are out there, industries that are out there. I would not want to be an attorney because either way, you're just in a fight. That's what you're spending time with, unhappy people who are constantly in a fight. Being a police officer, you are having to look at the darkest sides of life all the time. You get to see some of the wonderful things too, but honestly, you're looking at bad behavior all the time. You're looking at impolite behavior, people doing really horrid things. It's hard to imagine it's not going to affect you on many levels throughout your life. It's not going to impact how you see the world.
And the reality is that many of us get into law enforcement because we want to make a difference. And all too often we're confronted with circumstances that no matter what we do, it's not going to fix the circumstance that we're being confronted with. And, you know, when you're talking about tragedy, traffic collisions where a child's been killed and those sorts of things, it's just, I had an experience where I was working 77th Division, the first division I worked at the LAPD early on in my career, and we were the secondary unit in a vehicle pursuit of a stolen vehicle. And it was going southbound on Figueroa. And as it went through the intersection of Figueroa and Martin Luther King Boulevard, there was a van traveling eastbound that the vehicle ran into, and it was a family, and the three young kids were ejected and lie dead and along the curb. And the suspect got out of the vehicle and started running, and officers were able to take him into custody. But here you had a mother and a father that were present at this scene, and their three children were laying dead. Wow. And it's very tough. You can't tell me that experience as a police officer is not going to impact you, because there's probably no sadder moment than that for the people that love those children. And even for those that don't even know those children, it was trying for me. It was very difficult, because we were in pursuit of this individual, and we have to, it's all about balance. Did the risk justify what we were doing? Because it essentially was a property crime, stolen vehicle. It wasn't stolen at gunpoint. It was just a property crime. But now we had three young lives that were lost because this individual chose to be irresponsible and flee from the police. And it's just tough. So you ask the questions, are we doing this the best way we can? But it does, it impacts you. Those sorts of things impact.
Making the hard call. These guys are making the hard calls every day, and it's got to weigh on you. Do you think that mental health is being addressed well enough in these police departments to deal with those experiences that happen that help people move through that?
It's getting better, but it's not where it needs to be. Because the reality is this, if you're struggling and you go to behavioral science services, the city of Los Angeles, they may even diagnose you with PTSD and know exactly what incidents you've been exposed to that have created that circumstance and that you are struggling. But they'll also tell you, don't tell your department, don't tell your commanding officer, because they'll take your gun and put you in the rubber gun squad and that sort of thing. And like I said, there's a whole stigma behind it. It'll negatively impact your career and stuff. So unfortunately, people just ride it out and they do the best that they can, but they oftentimes turn to ways to medicate how they're feeling, which unfortunately oftentimes is alcohol. And then that causes stresses on their relationships at home, you know, whether it's with their wife or their girlfriend or their children. And then it also oftentimes involves financial troubles because people spend money to make themselves feel better when they're dealing with things that they don't fully understand themselves. So now you have these three critical areas that you're failing in. Well, really four. First, you have a problem, but you don't want to address it. That's the first problem. And then and secondarily, you're medicating it with something that's not going to help you. It's going to make it worse. And your relationships aren't there to support you because they're failing because of how you're handling everything. And then your finances are going to fall short. So you take those all those stressors and put them into one place. It's a heck of a burden to carry.
Certainly gives us another perspective to look at that the challenge of being a police officer in some of these markets is beyond what a lot of people could handle. And we need to be able to be a little bit more empathetic and participate in making things better. It's not just left to one group, one entity, one industry. I appreciate this.
The statistics are really frightening. You lose about 60 officers a year from violence on the job, their lives taken by a suspect. And suicide for officers that are active, it's about 200 a year. So you're talking about four times as many police officers that are active are killing themselves. And we haven't even talked about the people that have retired and are struggling with PTSD and depression and things like that. Those that kill themselves, that's not even included in those numbers. So it's a huge problem. But we don't talk about it. We're all up in arms about people assaulting officers and officers being killed in line of duty. And we should be. But we've got another thing that is quietly and silently killing cops at a much greater rate. And that is suicide, a result of the lack of resources available to ensure that they're maintaining the mental health they need to be successful and live healthy careers and then have a healthy retirement afterwards.
Wow, I hope that this has moved a lot of people in listening to this today. When there's rhetoric out there about defunding the police, and I lose my mind when I hear it. Are you kidding? Do you want to see a society that doesn't have police? Are you joking me? This is something that'll just take me to the wall because you can't imagine. You just can't imagine how bad it will be without the support of our police department. So I think you've just brought some really good points of view. And this, I really hope that what a great idea it would be that your book would become a mandatory read in colleges in specific departments, whether it's sociology or whether it's law enforcement. And wouldn't it be fabulous if that professor would use this book as an opportunity to teach, inform, create some empathy. And then they had a chance to see you at the end of the year, come and speak at that college. Boy, if that wouldn't bring it home, I don't know what would. I think you're the perfect spokesman for this whole movement that needs to take place. And I have to ask you, in your speaking, do you feel that it's made that specifically, that activity has made a big difference in being able to accomplish your mission?
It, to the extent that it expands your exposure, there's still a lot to be gained, especially from the people that are currently in law enforcement. There's a large segment of those people that don't want to change. They think that everything's fine, that I'm just unrealistically optimistic. And I challenge that thought process. That's why in my book, I support everything by empirical evidence and research. I interview world-renowned experts in the areas of training and education and performance under stress for law enforcement officers and give their insights. So that this isn't me sharing my opinion. I'm sharing what I have learned as a result of my efforts to reach out and to get a better understanding and have better insight into what will make law enforcement better. And throughout this process, I had some of my own ideas, some of my own ideas that I learned weren't quite accurate. And so I learned from that. So this is about, like I said, creating the dialogue and being willing to look at how other people are doing things. And like when you talk about the defund the police, and I talked about looking at the Nordic countries, if you want law enforcement to improve and look outside their insular culture to find ways to improve themselves and look at success stories in law enforcement agencies in other countries, then I would encourage citizens to understand that defunding the police is not the answer, because the answers requires money, and the answers involve spending the money to better educate, better train, and better pay law enforcement officers. And we can't be stuck with this mentality that we're going to do more with less. It's been a recipe that has not worked for decades. It did not work for the entire time that I was in law enforcement out in Los Angeles, and it certainly is not going to work moving forward. And that we need to look at these solutions and not come up with these media grabbing phrases, defund the police, that really serve no purpose other than to really, in my mind and in my words, demonstrate the ignorance of the person using those phrases in really knowing what needs to be done to make the improvements.
This is a time of change, of needed change, and certainly everything, all of the garbage is floating to the top, which is great. Can't clean it out until you're willing to see it and really look at it all the way around. And certainly we're having that opportunity right now. And luckily for us, we have people like you that have experience and expertise and an educated perspective that can make a difference where people are going to start listening. They have to listen. If you want it to be different, can't keep doing the same thing and expecting it's going to be different. We're going to have to get more involved. So I am very grateful for you and the work that you're doing. But when people look back at the body of work years from now that you've had, what do you hope they say that you stood for?
That the fact that I'm honest and I have integrity, and that I had an ability to approach the issues in a manner that facilitated the dialogue that was necessary, and that I didn't talk at people. I was extending a hand to speak with people to try to come up with the solutions that will best serve law enforcement in the United States.
You are a gift. What is lighting you up right now? What's the next thing in your mission? What's the next thing in your business or your personal evolution that has you on fire, that gets you up every day excited?
Really, I'm looking at what is my ultimate goal, and then how do I achieve that, making it the easiest I can for those people to hear my message and understand my vision. So I want to create rather than having to go to a law enforcement agency and do all this consultation, do all that formally, I want to create these videos that are really like 15 minutes long. So say you're chief of police in a small law enforcement agency, because the reality is 70% of law enforcement agencies in the United States police communities of 10,000 people or less. So how often are you going to have an officer involved shooting that may create some division between the law enforcement agency and the community that you serve? You may not have one for decades, but then you have one. You now need to know what to do, because the post management of those incidents is the most critical thing when you're talking about the police community relationship. So if you're a chief of police, you'll be able to just download a 15-minute video of me speaking about the blueprint that you need to follow to be successful, and take what you need from that blueprint that matches the specific circumstances of your agency in that particular moment in time to be successful with that. So it's not about reaching out to me and me having to go and all these billable hours. That's not what it's about. My vision is about making this easy and trying to create means for people to be able to access what I have to share in a very easy and meaningful way. So that's what I'm focusing on. Like I said, I'm probably jump into writing my next book, and it's going to be about what we just talked about, the mental health of law enforcement officers during and after their careers. I think that that's very important. The reality is that I hear a lot, "Oh, you're not loyal to law enforcement," because I tell the truth. And there's a lot about law enforcement that's wonderful and outstanding, but there's things that we have to admit that we need to improve upon. And you can't expect to make those improvements unless you're honest about what those deficiencies are. You have to first identify and acknowledge that they exist. But unfortunately, there's a segment of law enforcement that doesn't want to do that, and they view you as being disloyal. I'm farthest thing from disloyal. I bleed blue. I want law enforcement to be successful moving forward. And that's really what drives me to do what I'm doing. So it's really about partnerships. I'm making partnerships with a friend of mine who has a company that has a background in media, where we're going to be reaching out to various businesses, whether it's a small mom and pop business all the way to large corporations, where they have critical incident plans put into place, where they're from A to Z, what they need to do prior to an incident happening, in the moment the incident is occurring, and in the post-incident management, and having that already done for them. So it's like I said, once again, it's about having the right people in place with the expertise levels that they have. Do I have the expertise of a decade of media? I don't. So what have I done? I partnered up with somebody that has that expertise, and together we're going to be moving forward. I've partnered up with Pliant Technologies, which is a company that has technological advancements for law enforcement relative to force options on how to better handle critical incidents where you have bad actors that aren't being compliant, and how can we better do that to avoid the Rodney King incidents or the George Floyd incidents or those sorts of things. And I've partnered up with them. So it just one thing I have learned is that if there's probably something 6 months from now that I'm going to be doing that right now I could never even imagine I would be doing in my with my company, because opportunities just present themselves in ways that you never would ever imagine.
The magic of life. When you're on the right track and you're doing what you were meant to do, and I call it being in your lane, the opportunities show up for you to deliver what you were meant to do. And I feel like you have such a powerful strategy that you're bringing to the world, and I think it's going to make a difference. I want to tell you today, Jeff, what a ride. I cannot thank you enough. You really showed us in such a visceral way a world I think that most people only see from the outside, and you do it with this incredible stamina and a hell of a lot of wisdom, and certainly with heart as well. I can't tell you how much I appreciate having you on the spotlight.
Well, I appreciate you having me. It's been a pleasure.
It was a pleasure. You've really given us a perspective that's it's not just valuable, but it's real, especially for leaders who want to do it better and they want to lead smarter and they want to build trust instead of just demanding it. I certainly got to see how you walk around and take in other perspectives, and it's beautiful. I appreciate it. The leadership, it's certainly you've shown us it's not about control, it's about responsibility and accountability and clarity and owning the impact of your voice, especially when the pressure's on. You certainly know about that from the inside out. And reimagining a system doesn't mean burning it down. It's really about elevating the standards and starting with who we choose to lead and how we train them and to serve us. And that is amazing. I've appreciated this conversation so much. For those of you listening, if you want to dig deeper into Jeff's world, go over to jeffweninger.com and learn about the consulting work he's doing. You can go to lawenforcementconsultants.com. And you don't want to miss this book. It comes out in August, right around the corner, right as this is going to be launching, actually, this episode. It's called On Thin Ice, an LAPD Veteran's Journey to Reimagining Policing. It's available on Amazon. It's incredibly powerful and timely. I am so glad that we're getting a chance to take a look at this now. It's raw, it's thoughtful, it's packed with real-world insight that most of us would never get access to otherwise. And then on top of which, no, he doesn't have enough time on his hands. He's created populouspublishing.com, and his focus is to provide the total control for authors to have for their story and the narrative. So if you've got a book idea and you need help publishing it, this is a great opportunity. Check it out. It's your vision, your narrative, your book. Populouspublishing.com is the place to go see where it can be done, and you're completely in control. That's amazing. So Jeff's work's a powerful reminder. Public speaking, it's not just about sharing ideas, it's about shaping culture. And he's using his platform to bring it all. I love it's not just nuance, it's integrity and accountability into one of the most complex conversations of our time. That's what using your voice for good actually looks like. So thank you again for joining us today. I already know I'm going to be calling you saying, okay, you're doing your next book. I really want you to come back on the show. I hope you'll come.
Oh, I absolutely would. Absolutely.
Everybody out there, if you love this episode, I'd appreciate it if you took a few moments to share it, like it, subscribe. I love bringing you valuable content that is useful and thought-provoking. And I love hearing your takeaways from these things. So please feel free to reach out. I love hearing about it. This show is so about showing you how powerful your voice is, not just for building a business, but for shaping the world around you. And when you speak up with purpose, people pay attention. They listen to Jeff. I see him. I hear him. He's made a difference on how I think about a couple of things, and that's a great conversation. So, with that said, thank you, Jeff, again for being here. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. And as always, I look forward to our next conversation. I'll see y'all next time. Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive once again into the remarkable stories and insights of our incredible guests. Their experiences and hard-earned, time-tested wisdom are not just meant to inspire you, but to provide you with actionable steps to take on your own path to success. Remember, you have a story to tell, and your voice has the power to transform your business and make lasting impact. And that's what it's all about. If you found value in today's episode, let us know. And I hope you'll take a moment and subscribe to The Spotlight wherever you listen to your podcasts so you never miss a thought-provoking or idea-producing conversation. I'm Kelly O'Hara, and I can't wait to see you back here for the next episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight.